Hi, good morning, everybody. As Dan said, I'm Michelle. I'm a student at Carnegie Mellon, and I'm going to talk today about ZZFS, which is a file system for spontaneous users. And this is joint work with several people from Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK, where I had an internship. So in an ideal world, if Alice here is out running some errands on the go, and she wants to take a look at her financial spreadsheet, check on her budget, we think that she should be able to do that immediately. She should be able to get the most up-to-date copy of that spreadsheet, regardless of which device she updated it from last, regardless of if her husband also updated that spreadsheet recently, anything like that. Now, at this point, several of you are thinking, I already have that. It's called Google Spreadsheets. And that's certainly true. But one of the underlying principles of our work is that you don't always want to put all of your data in the cloud. You don't always want to give it to Google or some other corporation. And I'll talk a little bit more about that going forwards. So our work also focuses on personal data as opposed to corporate or enterprise data. And you might think that that simplifies things a bit, but in some ways it actually makes it just as complex or even more complex. So personal data requires collaboration. That could be on household management tasks, like Alice and her husband working on that budget document, as I mentioned. Could also be beyond the household. So for example, if my sister and I want to collaborate over a long distance to make a photo slideshow for my grandmother's birthday, something like that. Personal data requires coordinating devices. So these are all the different devices that you might have: laptops, desktops, tablets, mobile phones. And of course, they all come from different manufacturers, and they all have totally different operating systems. And of course, this set of devices changes frequently as people buy new ones and get rid of their old ones. And personal data requires handling write workloads that are sometimes unexpected. So one example, which comes from the Live Mesh mailing list of something that seems like it just ought to work, is that it turns out that listening to music is not actually a read-only workload. You read the data of the song, but then you also go back and write database updates of things like the play count and most recently played song, things like that. And so that can create conflicts where two versions of the database don't agree. And so we think that ideally all of these things should just work correctly in a seamless way for users. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that doesn't always work in the real world, and I'm just going to focus on one of them today, which is unavailable devices. So in this example of Alice looking at her financials, if her laptop had been on, she would have just been able to retrieve that document right away. But if her laptop was actually, you know, closed or shut down sitting in her house, then she wouldn't be able to get it, even though she had a perfectly good internet connection that she should be able to retrieve it. Similarly, if I'm working with two devices and I'm switching back and forth between my laptop and my tablet, if I always close the laptop and then wake up the tablet and vice versa, they're never actually on at the same time, and so it's difficult for them to sync that data together. And again, if I'm trying to retrieve some remote data from somewhere, possibly from the cloud or another device, especially if my network connection is slow, I might have to wait a while after I open up that laptop for the data to come down, when that data could have been prefetched for me if only the laptop were on. And these are just a few examples of the way that devices being unavailable inhibits the ability to get your data on demand, even when you have perfectly reasonable internet connections. And when thinking about this problem, it's really important to also think about human factors. So lots of people have thought about this problem in lots of ways in the past. One approach is, of course, eventual consistency, things like CODA and many other systems. But of course, the problem with that is that people want their data right now, and eventual consistency is, it's sort of right there in the name, eventual. Other systems have tried to build on top of eventual consistency to allow things to be pre-planned. So in systems like Perspective and Onzaire, users can specify which files they're going to need and have them sort of prefetched and hoarded to the devices where they're going to be used. The problem with this is that users are spontaneous. They don't always know or are able to plan what they're going to need ahead of time. As I mentioned before, you could store all this data in a public cloud, but there are also some issues with this, especially related to trust and control. Users actually want to know where their data is and they want to have control over it, especially in some specific cases. And so what we're asking in this work is whether we can find a way to combine some of the best features of each of these. If we can provide that same kind of availability and on-demand data, while still providing the sense of trust and control that users are looking for, and without requiring them to plan ahead. And so I'm going to talk about ZZFS, which is a file system that we built as an approach to this problem. And basically, the main idea here is that we make more devices available. So we're going to turn on devices that are off, and as a result, we're going to make more devices be consistently available and reduce the chance that you're not going to be able to talk to that device to complete the ability to move the data around or the consistency protocol that you're trying to do. And in the design of this system, we're going to work hard to support users by allowing them to access their data without pre-planning, and we're not going to force them to put their data in specific places or second-guess their choices about how they want to handle their data. And to do this, we're going to combine some cool new hardware that I'll talk about with some best practice storage system techniques to try to achieve these goals. So in the rest of the talk, I'll talk a bit about the design of ZZFS, and then I'll briefly go over our implementation and evaluation before I conclude. So some of the major design considerations in ZZFS, which I'll mention briefly and then explain in a little more detail. First, as I mentioned, human factors were very important to our design, and we ran some user studies to try to get some insight to inform our design. The hardware that we use is a low-power network interface card that we use to turn on devices. This is sort of like Wake on LAN, but a bit more powerful, and I'll talk about that too. And we use some well-known storage system best practices, including things like version histories for consistency and I/O offloading as needed to improve performance. So in terms of human factors, our goal here is to try to understand how and why people are storing, organizing, and accessing their data. And we don't just want to know how they're doing it today. We want to understand their motivations and what their goals are so we can think about how they might do these things in the future. And we're going to use this information to try and inform our design decisions. We collected this information from a few different sources. First, we did an analysis of feedback of bug reports and feature requests from the Live Mesh and Dropbox services. Now, this looks at a pretty tech-savvy early adopter class of users, but it still provides some insight into the types of problems and needs that people have with this kind of service. And to do this, we basically went through a somewhat formal coding process to categorize these requests into different categories. We also performed a small-scale qualitative user study where we talked to users about their current practices and habits, as well as walking them through some storyboards about how they might like to use this kind of system in the future. And then some of the co-authors of this study also participated in a large-scale qualitative user study, which was able to get at a lot of these questions in a lot more depth. And that's going to be published this spring at the ACM Conference on Human-Computer Interaction. So our findings from these different studies, some of the highlights are as follows. First of all, we don't want to require hoarding. We find that people are busy and they really don't want to or have time to keep track of where they want to put their data or plan which data they're going to use when. And they don't always know what it is they're going to need before they need it. We also found that people's placement of their data is deliberate and reasoned. They actually put things on different devices for a reason. They know what device they want to put it on, and there are trust considerations related to which devices are used how, and especially related to cloud storage. And our findings on this dovetail with some other studies, including the one mentioned here. And so the upshot of all of this is that we just don't want to second-guess users' decisions. We don't want to force them to try to do things the way we think they should do them. We just want to support the decisions that they're making. So the hardware that we're using here is called Somniloquy. At our poster later, I'll have a couple of these to look at if you want to take a look at them. The idea here is that it maintains access to the computer while it's dormant by basically allowing us to wake up the device as needed in a way that's totally transparent to applications. This is not a contribution of our work. This comes from NSDI in 2009, but we just take advantage of it here. It consumes 10 to 100 times less power than an idle PC, so it's good for energy savings. And it also contains some onboard flash for temporary storage, which we're able to take advantage of in the design of our storage system, as you'll see. So in terms of the storage system itself, I'll highlight just a few things that I think are the most interesting or that give the most insight into how we take advantage of this always-on option. The metadata service, which is exactly what you would expect. It's how the devices find the data. A new component that we have called the I/O director, which sort of lets us tell the metadata service what to do. And then I will briefly review how I/O offloading works in case anyone's not familiar with it and provide some example use cases. So in the metadata service, we're providing a flat device transparent namespace so any of the devices can get to any of the files anywhere in the system. This metadata service itself could reside anywhere. You could replicate the content of it for reliability, or you could replicate the service using something like Paxos to provide availability. As a simple default for personal use, though, we chose to just implement a single instance of it, and we cached that on all of the different devices so that they only have to talk to the metadata service when things have changed. And we think that this is reasonable because we found, just like many other people have found, that the metadata size is a lot smaller than the size of the data. And so we think that this is certainly small enough to be easily stored and cached on any devices that we're using, even space-limited devices. The next component is the I/O director, which sits above the metadata service. And we use the I/O director to determine policy for how data will be stored and accessed. And so you could use it to set interesting policies about things like energy or cost. And the I/O director can set these kinds of policies because it has some new options for how to handle the placement and access to data. We have the ability to wake up a device when it's sleeping. We have the ability to do some offloading if a device is not available, to basically send a copy of that somewhere else, either to the onboard flash on Somniloquy, possibly to the cloud if that's available, or to other devices. Just to review quickly how the I/O offloading works, this builds on some past work that was also presented at FAST. And the idea here is just that if a device is not available and an update comes in for it, we just offload that update to a log on any spare resource that happens to be nearby. And then if anybody tries to read that data, they're redirected to the log so that the reads are always consistent with the most recent content. And all that offloaded data is eventually reclaimed by the device where it was intended to go. And this allows us to have online data migration, which is something that we talk about in the paper, but I'm not going to go into here. So a base case here is just sort of a standard read. This one's pretty straightforward. Basically, if Alice is out to lunch with a friend and she wants to show her friend some pictures of her new nephew using her phone, then her phone might ask the metadata service, where's that baby photo? It turns out it's on the desktop, so Alice's phone is just going to go to the desktop, which this time is on, and retrieve that photo. So cute baby, everyone's happy. That one's pretty basic. It gets a little bit more interesting if the desktop happens to be asleep. So in this case, we assume that the metadata is cached and Alice's phone knows where to find that baby picture. So it's just going to ask the desktop for the picture, at which point, because we're talking through the Somniloquy NIC, the NIC will actually be able to wake up that device, which will turn on, and after a short delay, be able to send that picture back. The basic write case is somewhat similar. In this case, we have Alice's financial spreadsheet, which is actually replicated in two places. The primary copy is on the desktop, and the secondary copy is on the tablet. And so Alice's phone will again ask the metadata service where that spreadsheet lives and be told that the primary copy is on the desktop. So it will go to the desktop to write an update to that spreadsheet, and the desktop will serialize writes to the secondary copy, and the write will complete. Now, if we think about a case where that secondary copy of the tablet happens to be dormant, one option that we might have if we equipped it with something like Somniloquy would be just to wake it up, similarly to how I explained in the read case. Another option that we have has to do with offloading. So in this case, the update gets written to the desktop, and because the tablet's not available, the desktop will actually just write that update to a log on the Somniloquy flash storage. And as a result, that write can complete immediately. There's not any waiting in this example beyond, you know, the network round trip time. So, and then later, when the tablet wakes up, the tablet will inform the system, hey, I'm awake again now, where does that log live? And it will be able to reclaim that data so that the update will propagate properly to the spreadsheet copy on the tablet. And that offloading log doesn't have to live in Somniloquy. It could also live in the cloud, or it could live on a laptop, anything like that. We do have some other placement options that we talk about in the paper. If we don't have a network connection, we don't have any magic. We can't magically make the data transfer without it. But we'll just do some pretty standard things involving offloading all of these remote writes to a log that happens to be co-located with the local device. And then when we do get connection again, we'll just reclaim those writes and use standard conflict resolution practices. We also have some options about moving either where the data itself is located or moving where the primary lives before a device goes to sleep so that we can reduce the amount of time we'll have to spend dealing with these problems if a device is asleep. And more of this is covered in the paper. Some other design considerations and limitations of our approach. We do assume that the users will have broadband at home and at least weak 3G connectivity most of the time while they're mobile. And Somniloquy is, of course, a prototype. It has some limitations around that. For starters, it only currently works on Windows Vista and Windows 7 machines, so we weren't able to test it on other kinds of things. There are also some security considerations regarding opening a port or using some Niliqui, which would have to be dealt with more thoroughly before you could use this for real. And finally, it's not immediately obvious that you would use something just like some Niliqui in the case of something like mobile phones or tablets. My phone is already sort of always on but kind of idle in my pocket. But the general principle here is not the specific Somniliqui hardware. It's that once you realize that devices can be on more of the time, you can take advantage of these kinds of options and rethink some of your assumptions. So next I'll talk briefly about our implementation and evaluation. So our implementation is a pretty simple application of this always-on design. It's written in user level in C, and it sits on top of NTFS or FAT. And we're able to run legacy applications with ZZFS using WebDAV DevTools, which allow us to basically mount ZZFS as a block device in Windows. And we do provide per-object replications. You can determine for each file how many replicas of it you'd like to have. By default, we are giving people one replica and leaving that exactly where it's created. But of course, you can specify that you'd like more copies and where you would like those copies to go. We have lots of different evaluations in the paper, but in the interest of time, I'll just talk about a few of them, particularly the ones that we think especially highlight features of this always-on model that are sort of unique to our system, and they mostly have to do with latency. So in this first example, we'll talk about read latency using a music scenario. So in this case, the user is listening to music. This music is evenly split between the local device and the remote device. It's not replicated, so every song is only in one of those places. And we're playing in shuffle mode, so basically at any time there's a uniformly random chance that you're going to pull a song from the local or the remote device. And the way that this works is based on a trace of Windows Media Player. And the idea here is that we'll just read the entire song in 64K chunks, and at the end we'll complete that small database write that I talked about at the beginning to update things like the play count. And our goal here is just to evaluate a worst-case scenario for our system, which is when that read request arrives at the remote device just as the remote device is shutting down. And there's no place else we can get the data, so we basically have to wait until it completes shutting down and then completes the process of turning back on so we can get to that data. So this is what happened when we tested this. On the y-axis, we have the latency of each request. That's a log scale. And on the x-axis, we just have wall clock time of how each of these requests happened. Just to orient you a little bit, at the bottom are the local reads. As you would expect, they're pretty fast because they're local. In the middle are those remote small writes, which are somewhat fast because they're smaller. And then this band is, of course, the remote reads, which are larger than the writes and so take a bit longer. The interesting thing on this graph is right here. This is our request up here in the circle at the top that is blocked because it's waiting for that standby and resume time. And so you can see that request actually takes about 23 seconds. And so the system is blocked for that period of time while we wait for the device to come down and come back up. And 23 seconds sounds like a lot. But if you think about it, if you're willing to prefetch just one song at a time, then the user will never notice that difference. And so we sort of find that although it's not great, we think we can live with that in most personal use scenarios. In addition, we think that number's coming down. That system that we tested was pretty old. Newer systems are doing better, more on the order of 10 to 15 seconds to do this kind of standby and resume, and we think that that's going to keep improving. Our next example has to do with write latency. In this case, we are simulating writes to an Office document that is actually replicated in two places. D1 is a local device and D2 is a remote device. And again, we're going to talk about the worst case where the remote device goes into standby just as we're trying to talk to it. In this case, however, instead of waiting for the remote device to come back up, we will offload that data to a third device that happens to be nearby while we wait for the second device to come back up. And you'll see that this actually masks that shutdown startup penalty that I mentioned. So here's what this looked like when we tried it. Basically, in this purple section here on the left, this is the normal operation at the beginning. So these writes are going both to the local and the remote device. At this first orange line, the remote device shuts down, and we start offloading to the third device. And so this is the performance while we're offloading here in green. You can see this gets a bit worse. That's mostly because the third device is just slower than the second device. It's located farther away, and it just operates less quickly. At this next line, the second device actually finishes waking up and starts reclaiming that data from the third device. And so you can see here that we're, again, paying a little bit of a penalty. Part of that is because we're now transferring twice as much data. We're transferring the ongoing writes as well as reclaiming the ones that had already happened from D3 to D2. But on the whole, the performance doesn't suffer too badly. And then finally, when reclaim ends, we return to exactly the performance we had at the beginning, where we're just writing each update to one local and one remote device. And so we can see that we're really not paying anything like that 23-second switch-on penalty from before. All of these things are, you know, well under a second, and most of them are under a tenth of a second. So this ability to do temporary offloading actually masks that cost. So just to sum up, ZZFS is a file system that makes spontaneous access to distributed content work better. We take advantage of a low-power, always-on communication channel that we can use because of some cool new hardware. And this helps us better execute the kinds of placement and consistency policies that we're looking for. This also helps us compensate for uncertainties, both in user behavior and in device availability. And this design takes into account human factors to try to make this work better for users. Thanks.
Okay, so curiosity got the better of me. Okay. And your last slide, what are the few random slow requests during that write case? There's this little noise
right
at the top. What
so,
causes that?
So we think that those were related to a problem with the wireless router that we were using when we took this example. We're not completely sure, but that's our best guess.
Hi, Jason Flynn from Michigan.
Hi, Jason.
Centralized storage has a lot of advantages, but you make some good points about the human factors issues in trusting that. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit, since you've thought about this issue, are there ways in which we could get people to trust centralized storage or use centralized storage?
First of all, I don't want to give the message that we should never use centralized storage, right? Or that people never want to use it. I mean, that's clearly not true, and I think there's lots of times when it is appropriate. So I think what we're trying to do here is just make it be one of your choices rather than sort of a predominating choice. But in terms of trying to help people trust it better, I think a lot of it is just going to be experience, right? So I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, but I can think of several companies which have had some bad experiences related to user data and trust, right? And every time that happens, it sort of eats away at the idea that, you know, even other companies, that you might be able to trust them properly with your data. So I think as we get better at this and as we, you know, continue to provide experiences, then that will help. I also think it would help to be able to help users visualize better what it is that you're doing to protect their data, because it's when it's just sort of this amorphous idea that, oh, my data is somewhere and I don't know where and I don't know who has it, right? If you could help concretize that for people a little bit, I think it would help. So.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, I'm Josh Berry from Riverbed Technology. I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about like cache coherency. So in your music example, right, you have some music songs on your remote device, some on your local device, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you have like a shared music repository, like you're sharing your music with your you know, brother or whatever,
right,
and someone goes and like updates a tag, like edits the comment field or something, how do you handle like propagating that out to your devices?
Okay, so I think I understood your question correctly. So basically, the idea that we have is that if you can make the devices be on, then you can just make all those updates basically synchronously and serialized. So when the update comes from my brother, when he plays that song, it gets updated. And then when I play that song, it also gets updated, and it's basically serialized and doesn't create a conflict. Is that the question you were asking?
Sort of. So I guess I'm thinking about races, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
If he tries to update it while you're in the middle of playing the song, like, how is there an issue there? Is it?
Okay. So we're using a basically this system is built on top of Everest, which is something that was built at MSR for a more enterprisey sort of situation, and it has lots of consistency protocols in it in terms of all the writes and things have to be serialized through the primary copy of the data. So it basically it doesn't let you write to it more than once at one time. I don't know if that makes sense.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's thank our speaker one more time.